you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, a live literary event series from LAist. We are back with guests, author Amanda Montell, and actor Bella Lavelle. You can find us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum. Tickets at laist.com/events.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us on this Wednesday. We so appreciate your support. I get a chance every day of our member drive to call a few listeners who've contributed the day before and offer my personal thanks. I've had some of the best conversations with listeners, people like you, who are so appreciative of what we do here at LAist 89.3. It's our honor, and we thank you so much. And I love all the people pick up and want to talk. It's great, because with all the spam calls, I always worry if anyone will pick up when I call. But that's very nice to have. What a great World Baseball Congress final game. The championship with Japan in a one-run victory over the U.S. And the Angels, two stars, Shohei Ohtani on the mound coming out of the bullpen, striking out the great Mike Trout, also of the Angels, his teammate. You just could not ask for a more dramatic game. Those World Baseball games, just incredible. It's going to make it hard for the regular MLB season to compete. I hope if you're a baseball fan, you had a chance to see that. We start today with a look at our weather. We have yet another one of these big storms, dropping record amounts of rain in some parts of greater Los Angeles. Joining us to talk about where we are in this storm, meteorologist in charge of the National Weather Service's Oxnard office, which serves the northern part of Metro LA, Ariel Cohen. Ariel, good to have you with us again. Where are we at with this storm? Seems like we're kind of in the middle. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And thanks so much for having me today. We have another atmospheric disturbance headed towards the area right now.
And what do we expect for the rest of the day and into tomorrow?
We're going to be having on and off showers and maybe even a thunderstorm affect the area as we head through the daytime hours this afternoon, even into the early evening hours. Could get some locally very heavy rain, have a flood watch still in effect. Also, some very small hail will be possible with this activity and gusty winds as well. Even the possibility for a few water spouts over the nearby Pacific waters. That's going to be rather unsettled weather continuing through the day today with cool temperatures in many locations, really staying in the upper 40s to lower 50s with this activity coming through. You know, tonight we'll probably have a few showers linger into the early evening hours. But we'll have a gradual clearing trend as we get late tonight and tomorrow, with mostly sunny skies expected by tomorrow as we get have the system move away from the area.
Now, we haven't had a ton of tornadoes here in Southern California. There have been a few. I remember a number of years ago, one did some damage to the facade of the L.A. Convention Center downtown. It came through parts of South L.A., up hit the Convention Center. But they're rare here. Last night, we had a tornado warning. What weather conditions gave rise to that?
The same large scale or very, very large storm system that's over the area is associated with a lot of spin in the atmosphere. And when we have coming ashore these individual shower and thunderstorm activity that cells that are coming on shore, they can sometimes bring, you know, that enhanced spin right onto land areas and bring us occasional weak tornadoes in general. And while the actual tornadoes themselves may be classified as weak tornadoes, they're still damaging. And so we had issued a tornado warning for an area where we had that heightened potential for a tornado to occur with some of that land falling shower and thunderstorm activity.
We're talking with Ariel Cohen, meteorologist in charge, National Weather Service's Oxnard office. Ariel, what rain is in the future forecast? Because it seems like we're getting every week a couple of days of rain as a new front arrives. Is that pattern ongoing?
That pattern continues, and so we're certainly going to continue with that chance for showers and thunderstorms through the day today and into this evening. We're looking for a drying trend, some warming temperatures as we head into this weekend. But by the time we get to early to middle parts of next week, we're looking at the potential for chances for precipitation to increase over the area. And so this overall pattern continues as we head into the latter parts of March and perhaps even into April as well. Confidence decreases as we head past this current storm system in terms of exact amounts and locations for precipitation, but the overall pattern of unsettled weather does continue.
Ariel, thank you so much as always. We really appreciate you sharing with us where things stand. Have a good rest of the day.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, and you too.
Thanks. From the National Weather Service Oxnard office, meteorologist in charge Ariel Cohen. Also with us is Eric Fetzer, who's project scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in La Cunada, Flint Ridge. Eric, it's so good to have you with us again. What are the atmospheric circumstances creating this chain of storms coming in from the Pacific?
Right now, it's obviously, as Ariel was saying, we have these very intense storms. One of the factors is, believe it or not, convection, thunderstorms on the other side of the planet over near Indonesia. And those actually can bring the jet stream far enough south that we get these very strong winter storms. There's also been some interesting storms because they've been, the last two big ones, the ones that led to all this snow in the San Bernardino Mountains, and the current one have come out of the north. So these have been very cold storms, but those cold storms have tapped in moisture from the tropics, from well past Hawaii. And so we've had this unusual situation of these cold storms bringing in a lot of moisture. And by the way, this is on the East Coast, people talk about nor'easter storms. This is the closest thing we get to this, where you have tropical moist air as what you would have in the East Coast, say off Florida, encountering very cold air off the continent. So these are just a couple of unusual storms,
yeah.
Always interesting, and rain is always good.
Usually good. What would break up this pattern? Because it seems like we've now seen for the past few weeks almost like clockwork arrival of these fronts.
Well, one of the things that does break it up is those thunderstorms over Indonesia move, and the jet stream, they no longer affect the jet stream over us, and the jet tends to move north as it normally does. As we all know, California is dry in the summertime, so the jet moves north as the summer progresses. And what we will see invariably is that jet moving north, and it's that connection, that teleconnection between the far tropical Western Pacific and us that's keeping the jet nearby these last couple of weeks. But invariably, the jet will move away. Sunny days are bound to come.
And looking longer term, what are the implications for our desert listeners? Because they'll often get, of course, these late summer monsoonal, very heavy rains, which can lead to flooding. Is there anything looking at the larger scale forecast that would have implications for them?
Well, as you mentioned, I think that we're coming out of a La Nina condition, and La Ninas tend to favor thunderstorms in the desert. And we're currently in somewhere between an El Nino and a La Nina. We're not sure whether we're going to end up in El Nino or not. But what's likely is we'll get something like normal rainfall in the deserts. Last year, we had a very wet summer in Arizona and parts of California, and that was likely related to the La Nina conditions in the tropical Pacific.
Okay. But if we do flip into El Nino, then we'd see less of that, more than likely.
Yeah.
And why do you think with the La Nina condition being dominant, we've seen such uncharacteristic high amounts of rain in Southern California?
Well, the La Nina's really lost dominance in the last two or three months. And so we started our winter with La Nina conditions, and those have gone to basically what's called Nino neutral, regular, normal, kind of normal tropical conditions. And at the same time, we've had this teleconnection, this so-called Madden-Julian oscillation connection with the far tropical Western Pacific. So those conditions have led to this jet stream moving further south and these more intense storms coming over us.
I want to thank you so much, Eric, for being with us and taking a look at some of the larger meteorological factors that are into play with our record-setting rainy season here in Southern California. Thanks. Have a good rest of the day.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. From the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, just north of our studios in La Cunada, Flint Ridge, project scientist Eric Fetzer with us today on Air Talk.
Support for LAS comes from Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubrias, The Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin Vote. Tickets at theatricum.com. Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting American Mariachi by Jose Cruz Gonzalez. It's the 1970s and women can't be mariachis. Or can they? American Mariachi is a feel-good comedy about familia, amor, and tradición that will send your heart soaring and put a bounce in your step with a wave of vibrant, infectious live music. On stage through June 9th, tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us at LAist 89.3. Bill's been introduced in the California legislature, which would protect doctors who mail abortion medication to people in states where those medications have been outlawed. The bill seeks to protect California physicians from being prosecuted. This follows up on other protections that the state legislature has passed for physicians who do abortions with people who have driven or flown from other states where abortion is banned to California to have the abortion done here. The bill would keep California doctors from being extradited to face charges in another state for providing the abortion medication, and it would shield doctors from having to pay fines. It would let California doctors sue anyone who tries to stop them from providing abortions. The bill would only apply to California doctors, and if a doctor left the state to provide an abortion to someone in another state, that protection would not go with the doctor. The doctor then would be subject to the laws of that state where the abortion is performed. Joining us to talk about the legal issues here is UC Davis, Professor of Law, Mary Ziegler. Professor, thank you for joining us again. We appreciate it. This is in line with other California laws that have been passed to try and further establish California as a state that is providing abortions to people not just who reside here, but from other states. What are some of the legal issues that come into play with protective efforts like this?
Well, I think a lot of them are kind of still to be, we have to wait and see, because we have yet to see conservative states actually try to pursue California doctors. But if they were to do that, there would be kind of a different number of issues when states take different positions, right? You could imagine a patient from Alabama getting pills from a California doctor. Would Alabama law apply or would California law apply? Would there be constitutional issues involved in that? Because the California doctor wouldn't know which law would apply to them, this bill notwithstanding. So you would have these kind of clashes set up that would likely go to the federal courts to resolve. And this bill, I think, is an effort to set California doctors up in the best possible position to survive those conflicts, but the outcome would still remain pretty unpredictable.
Opponents of abortion rights say that California doesn't have the legal latitude to do this because of the constitutional clause stating states must give full faith and credit to the laws of other states. Do you think that comes into effect here?
Well, the full faith and credit clause is pretty complicated in this situation, right? Because on the one hand, you could have California saying, well, you have to respect the laws in our state because where the abortion pills are being mailed, abortion is protected under our state constitution. And you could imagine the conservative state firing back, well, you know, you have to respect the laws in our state because the abortion is happening in a place where abortion is illegal, right? The pills are being consumed. So the abortion, if you will, as steps that are happening in the place where abortion is protected and a place where it isn't. So that's why this is so messy. This is not something that a federal court can just look at and say, oh, full faith and credit clearly means this side wins or this side wins. There's more nuance here, which is why we're kind of in uncharted territory in a lot of ways with challenges like this that could arise in the future.
What about the manufacturers of the two most commonly prescribed medications for this, mifepristone and misoprostol? What are their practices now with these bans on these medication abortions in some states? Do you know if the drug manufacturers are really reining in what they're doing?
Yeah, they seem to be. I mean, so that one of the lead distributors of mifepristone, which is, as you mentioned, is one of the two major abortion pills used in the two drug protocol for medication abortion. It was reported that they were reluctant to dispense mifepristone in 31 states they thought were hostile to abortion. We've seen less clear indication from manufacturers so much as distributors and pharmacies. But even what we're seeing from, you know, what we saw recently with Walgreens, what we saw with this, you know, the major U.S. distributor of mifepristone, it is in part that sometimes companies are reacting to the threat of legal action, not to legal action that's already unfolding in the courts or in state legislatures.
We're talking with UC Davis Professor of Law Mary Ziegler joining us. If you have questions about this California bill that was introduced by State Senator Nancy Skinner of Berkeley, the Democrat who has this bill, which would protect California-based physicians who mail abortion medication to states for patients where that medication is banned. If you have questions, we're at 866-893-5722. You can also email a question to atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and your first name. It just seems, Professor, that if you have a California physician who is actually mailing a medication to a state where it's banned, wouldn't that be tough to protect them from doing that? I just wonder, I mean, do physicians in California have that ability to dispense medication pretty uniformly to other states? Because I think of that as more a state-by-state thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are additional rules in the background here. I mean, physicians, in terms of telehealth, will often need to be licensed in the state where they're practicing. What is fairly clear from the standpoint of the law, there is that if someone comes to California to get an abortion, choice of law rules would mean pretty clearly that, you know, the California doctor would be protected. It's more ambiguous if an anti-abortion state is trying to prohibit shipping abortion medication to people in their states. From the standpoint of how the law would treat that, there'd be more unpredictability. And it may be that a federal court would say that federal law requires or at least exposes that California doctor to liability. So this bill, I don't think, is a guarantee of what would happen in the federal courts. It's instead, I think, California trying to signal as much as possible what its own rules are on the subject and to introduce as many protections as possible. But as I said, there's no guarantee those protections would hold up.
Professor, what sorts of exposure might someone who lives in a state where abortion is banned, who travels to California to have an abortion and then returns to that state of residence where it's banned, is that person who's had the abortion legally vulnerable to being charged in that state of residence after coming to California?
Well, at the moment, not likely. So there are a handful of states that don't especially foreclose the possibility of punishing women and other pregnant people for abortion, South Carolina, Georgia. But for the most part, states that have criminalized abortion at the moment have explicit exemptions for the criminal prosecution of people who for having abortions, right, for pregnant people and women. There's no guarantee, of course, that that's going to last, because the more unable states are to prosecute doctors, whether that's doctors in their home states or doctors elsewhere, the more they're going to look for alternatives. And so far, the alternatives have been seeking to prosecute people who donate to abortion funds themselves, or friends or family members who help people buy pills, but never the person having the abortion. You're starting to see a backlash against that in some conservative states, where legislators are essentially saying, you know, why aren't we punishing women and pregnant people? It would be a lot more straightforward. It would be a lot easier. It would be consistent with our arguments that abortion is murder. So at the moment, consequences for the pregnant person are not likely, but I don't think we can assume that that will remain the case in the long term.
Of course, you know, the public fallout from that can be extreme when those stories are reported in local newspapers and the like, and it puts a face and a name to the person who's being prosecuted, who's gone elsewhere to get an abortion. That may have a big effect on public opinion once it's personalized in a way like that. What's your sense also of with these restrictions being enacted on the percentages of abortions that are done through medication versus in office or in clinic procedure? Is currently, I think it's like 54% of mm-hmm. abortions are done through medication. Do you think that percentage is going to shift?
I mean, we're seeing kind of countervailing trends on this post-ops, right? So on the one hand, we're seeing more interest in pills, especially in states that have criminalized abortion, simply because it's much harder to crack down on access to pills. On the other hand, I think we're seeing that for people who are forced to travel out of state, that process is a cumbersome and difficult one, financially, logistically, for people who have to take time off of work, get childcare, afford a trip out of state, afford a hotel. And as a result, we're seeing the number of second trimester abortions increasing substantially as well. And second trimester abortions, by definition, are going to be surgical. So I think it's whether we see a big increase in medication abortion or not kind of remains to be seen, because those trends are kind of pushing in opposite directions.
Professor, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for sharing your expertise with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's UC Davis law professor Mary Ziegler, one of the nation's preeminent experts on abortion law, frequent guest with us on Air Talk. But that's not the only place. You hear her on NPR programs. You see her on all the television news networks. We're very fortunate to get to talk with her on a regular basis about these major changes that are occurring in abortion rights laws across the country.
Support for LAS comes from Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubría's The Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin Vote. Tickets at theatricum.com. Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Mix Mix, the Filipino Adventures of a German Jewish Boy by Boney B. Alvarez. Inspired by true events from the life of Ralph Price, after escaping Nazi Germany, a newfound tropical refuge in the Philippines is upended when Japan invades the islands. On stage through June 16th. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. With California's Democratic supermajority in the state legislature, it's arguably given labor unions, environmental groups, consumer groups, and trial lawyers unprecedented leverage. They're the big spenders on the campaigns for Democratic members of the state assembly and the state senate. In an effort to fight the progressive legislation that's come out of that coalition of legislators and those interest groups have been business entities which have come up with a host of ballot measures to try and undo progressive laws that were passed by the legislature. You've seen this, you know, very recently with ride-hailing companies, Uber and Lyft, and their challenge to the gig economy law that was passed by the state legislature, which would make make them employee status instead of independent contractors, those that drive for the ride hailing companies. Well, there have been a number of other of these, whether it's in tobacco bans or other things where the companies have tried to fight back against the legislation. Well, now in Sacramento, we have a bill that would make it more challenging for those business interests to qualify a referendum on laws that are passed by the legislature. With us is California Assemblymember Isaac Bryan. His district includes parts of Southwest Los Angeles, Culver City, and South LA. Assemblymember Bryan, thank you so much for joining us. Share with us specifically what your new bill would do.
Well, thank you for having me, Larry. I always appreciate what you do. Yeah, this is, you know, I know that this is often being framed as a labor versus corporation fight, and that's a perfectly fine framing for some. For me, that's not the intention of the bill. The intention of the bill is to right a wrong in one of our most democratic processes. The referendum process was designed to empower the everyday voters of California. It was designed over 110 years ago, and that process has been subverted by a concentrated group of powerful interests. I don't care what interest they are. They're pouring tens of millions of dollars to confuse voters, to lie to voters, to manipulate the will of voters, and to undo the work of the people's legislature at a time when the legislature more accurately reflects the population of California than any time in California's history.
Now, it's not uncommon for people that are circulating the petitions for referendum, regardless of their political orientation, to not be fully factual, to omit important information. How does this get at that issue of not providing full disclosure to prospective signers of the petitions?
Yeah, what this referendum change would make is it would require all petition signature gatherers to be trained, to be registered. It would list the top three funders of a referendum at the top of the page, along with a impartial statement by our attorney general about what this measure does, all above the signing line where folks are required to sign. It would also clear up ballot confusion. Currently, voting yes on a referendum to overturn the law means keeping the law, which is understandably confusing to voters. So we're going to clean up that part as well. It's not just, you know, elaboration or fabrication or omission of facts that's happening right now. I'll give you an example. Last year, we passed a bill that took over two decades to end the drilling of new oil wells within 3,200 feet of where we eat, sleep, play, and go to school. And immediately the oil companies spent over $25 million where they went out and they told voters, if you don't want neighborhood oil drilling, sign right here. To undo the law that ended neighborhood oil drilling. It's unconscionable. It is not fair to voters. And we're going to make it a truly democratic process like it should be.
But that can be challenged in the courts, right? That isn't allowed, in fact, to be deceptive with people you're trying to convince to sign the petition. So, and as I recall, weren't there legal challenges to those specific tactics?
There absolutely are, but that ongoing process takes a lot of time. And what happens is when a ballot measure or a referendum, I should say, qualifies, it puts the law on hold. And so, for example, that oil drilling law has been put on hold for 2 years. And during that process where it's on hold, I represent the largest urban oil field in the country, in the Inglewood oil field. That oil field is actively applying for new drilling permits during this window, by which they should not be allowed to because of a subverted referendum process. We've got to get this right. We've got to make sure that the voice of the people is heard both in the legislature and on the referendum process in an honest, transparent, and organized way. We can't have well-powered collective interests undoing the work of 40 million Californians.
We're talking with California Assemblymember Democrat Isaac Bryan. He represents a large swath of southwest Los Angeles, including Baldwin Hills, the Crenshaw District, Ladera Heights, also parts of west and south Los Angeles included in his district. We're talking about his bill, which would make some dramatic changes in the way that signatures are gathered for referenda against a law that's been passed by the state legislature. One of the requirements, Assemblymember Bryan, is for 10% of the signature gatherers to be volunteers. Now, that gives a significant advantage to labor unions that have free labor through their members to be able to do that. Doesn't that disadvantage businesses that are trying to qualify a referendum?
Not at all. I think that this gives the power back to everyday people. The way the referendum process was designed was so that people who feel passionately about an issue can go out and convince their neighbors and their friends and can organize. You can't be mad at labor unions for being good organizers any more than you can be bad at good neighbors who organize their community, block clubs, who organize book clubs, other groups of people in the community who have a strong interest, parents who organize to speak loudly about the interests of their children. This is a process that requires that just 10%, at least 10% of people who are trying to get a referendum on the ballot actually care enough to go out and collect signatures and aren't solely out there because they are being paid by an organized, well-powered special interest, corporations, labor, or otherwise.
Cal Matters journalist, longtime veteran Dan Walters, writing about this, said there is a Supreme Court decision from 35 years ago that might come into play in which the court overturned a Colorado law that had banned a statute against paid signature gatherers. And the Legislative Council looked at that aspect and determined whether there is any vulnerability to constitutional challenge over that requirement for volunteer signature gatherers?
Absolutely. And there have been other court cases. That particular court case banned paid signature gathering outright. What we're proposing is not a ban on paid signature gathering. What we're proposing is that a very minimal threshold, 10%, need to be people who actually care and are willing to volunteer their time. The other 90% can be paid folks who don't care, who are collecting by signature, who you can amass in a large groundswell based on the amount of resources you have. You can still do that process. I think that that's wrong personally, but in adherence to that court ruling, we're going to just cap this at a 10% volunteer threshold. We know that's reasonable. We know that's possible. And quite honestly, if you're trying to do the undo the will of 40 million Californians, you should have a portion of your folks be volunteers who care.
And real quickly, just final question, with the additional training and other requirements for signature gatherers, that would presumably, for that 90% that are paid, up the price and the hours involved for them. Is this going to mean that the challenges are pretty much going to come from the biggest companies of all and, in a sense, end up unintentionally favoring them in the process?
I don't believe so at all. We deserve to have signature gatherers who have a fundamental understanding of what they can and can't do when it comes to misleading voters as they're trying to gain these signatures. There's a discrepancy right now, an imbalance between the signature gathering process for a ballot initiative and the signature gathering process for a referendum in terms of the training that's required. This rights that balance.
Assemblyman, thank you as always. We appreciate you being with us today on Air Talk.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you. That's Assemblymember Isaac Bryan, the Democrat from Southwest, West, and South Los Angeles, Culver City as well, joining us on Air Talk. And speaking of events, Air Talk is on the road a week from tonight. I'll be at Caltech's Beckman Auditorium, beautiful large venue, six of our COVID-19 doctors are going to be convening that night. We'll talk with them about what has changed in their professional lives since they started joining us more than 3 years ago, providing their COVID-19 expertise on Air Talk. Dr. Peter Chin Hong is coming down from UC San Francisco to be on stage at Caltech next Wednesday night. Dr. Dean Blumberg of UC Davis Children's Hospital in Sacramento likewise will be catching a flight and coming down to be a part of that program next Wednesday night. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital, Dr. Robert Kim Farley, other physicians, Dr. Shruti Gohill of UC Irvine. It's going to be a terrific evening with our docs on stage at Caltech's Beckman Auditorium. To get your tickets, go to LAIST.com/events. That's LAIST.com/events. I sure hope to see you at Caltech next Wednesday evening for our summit of our COVID-19 doctors to talk about what we've learned over the past 3 years and for you to just meet the doctor. Great opportunity to see them on stage and to hear what they have to say about their own specific work. I'm very pleased to be joined by the newest member of the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors, representing the 3rd District, Supervisor Lindsay Horvath, former mayor of West Hollywood and multi-term member of the West Hollywood City Council. Supervisor Horvath, thank you very much for being with us today.
So happy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the specifics about eviction restrictions, just with your first few weeks on the job here so far, any surprises for you?
Well, I think the biggest surprise has been sort of peeling back the onion of myself for other people and helping people understand really who I am and what I'm about in this role. And I think we've been pleasantly surprised to see how many people want to partner with us in the work that we're doing throughout the district, no matter what neighborhood we go. And it's been nice to be welcomed into so many different communities and to have people willing to work with us to show us exactly how we can prioritize the work that they need to see from the county.
Let's talk about the proposal that was voted down by your colleagues yesterday on the board. It would have extended protections against eviction to renters in unincorporated Los Angeles County. You strongly supported that along with Supervisor Ilda Solis. What were your reasons for wanting to extend these protections or restrictions on eviction?
So actually, I want to correct the record. It was not an extension of the COVID-19 moratorium. I think there was a lot of confusion. I think it was intentional, but we were not extending COVID-19 eviction moratorium protections. Those expire at the end of March. What we were bringing forward were longer-term protections that we believe renters need because we are facing a homelessness crisis. And the most important thing that we can do to address that crisis is not only to get people housed, but keep them in the housing that they're already in. And these protections would have afforded people the ability to stay in housing that they are paying for, on leases that they are adhering to, would have limited the amount that rent could be increased. So rent could even be increased, but only by a small amount because we know people are struggling to keep up with rent as it is and figuring out how to pay back due rent with in partnership with their landlord. So there's a lot that's going on here. We wanted to have these protections to make sure that we're helping people stay in housing they can otherwise afford.
Why not allow the landlords to be able to increase rents commensurate with their expenses? Because as we know, the cost of labor and materials has skyrocketed, particularly since the start of the pandemic. Overall costs for property owners have gone up considerably. Why not allow, as a part of this, the landlords to be able to recoup those costs?
Well, the state has already restricted the amount that rent can be increased. So there are already restrictions in place. Our proposal simply would have extended those restrictions because we know that renters are struggling to afford the housing that they're in and, more importantly, are committed to paying back due rent to the best of their ability. We know that property owners need to have a bit of an increase to address the cost that you mentioned. But we also are trying to keep renters in housing and prevent our homelessness crisis from getting even worse. And we've seen, for example, in San Diego, which lifted their COVID protections in the later part of last year, that they have now reached homelessness numbers highest in 5 years. We don't want to see that kind of increase in Los Angeles County. We can't afford to see it. And so we're doing everything that we can to work with property owners who want to keep people in that housing. And so that's why the county has initiated funds that I think it's to the tune of $45 million to support renters and small landlords to keep people in that housing.
Now, your colleague, Supervisor Catherine Barger, says none of that money has been distributed. Why not?
Because I think in part because people don't know about it. And so that was the first half of our motion focused on four different protections. The second half of our motion, which did pass unanimously, has report backs on how we can better educate people about the resources that are available. And I think we made this money available to property owners. So for those property owners who are calling in complaining to us that they need help, we have provided that assistance. It exists. We are just waiting for them to apply through DCBA.
That's just because when we've talked with, apartment property owners organization, they seemed aware of it. They talked about it with their membership. So I didn't realize it was people not applying. I assume they've applied, but that the bureaucracy has kept those applications from being funded. But let's go back to you're saying that if people were evicted, that would increase homelessness. If you had a property owner, though, that evicts someone who's brought animals into the property in violation of the lease, or additional people moved into the property in violation of the lease, and if the property owner were to evict under those terms, that would open up that unit for other people to move into, right? So yes, it would be the challenge for the people who violated the lease to find another place to live, but it would open up that unit for someone who might well be homeless to move into that now open unit.
But a lot of the people who have brought people into their homes during this time of crisis are people who couldn't afford to both go to work and pay for childcare during that. They couldn't do both in order to keep their jobs. Sometimes people couldn't afford the rent on their own because they lost their jobs. So you are actually displacing people who are at greater economic risk of being able to find housing that they can otherwise afford. Certainly it will open up units, but it doesn't mean that anybody's going to be able to afford to move into them. Conversely, if you keep people in units that they have been able to afford going into the pandemic and help them bridge this gap, we can keep people in housing, prevent an increase in homelessness, and hopefully help stabilize the housing and homelessness crisis we're seeing throughout the region.
We're talking with Los Angeles County Supervisor Lindsay Horvath, joining us to talk about what she had supported in the way of providing protections for renters against eviction, making it more difficult for landlords to evict those that were there, including people who brought additional residents into the property they were renting or brought pets into the property. This make it more challenging for landlords to do evictions. However, the majority of the board voted down this proposal from Supervisor Horvath and Supervisor Solis. Supervisor Horvath, what comes next in your effort to try and extend renter protections?
Well, we know that a majority of LA County residents are renters, so a majority of residents in Los Angeles County are at risk of losing their housing now that all of their protections are being lifted. So first, we want to encourage people to visit stayhousedla.org if they feel they are at risk of eviction. There are a lot of resources there to make sure that people can get legal assistance and support to stay housed. We will continue to fight for longer term protections. We've heard consistently from our colleagues that they are open to considering protections that are permanent and longer term and not related to a time of crisis. So we will be exploring that. And we also encourage local cities to adopt rental protections. The county will be hosting a summit this coming June. And so that will provide more information. But there are a lot of resources out there that are available to help cities stand up their own protections and make sure that people are able to stay housed.
Supervisor Horvath, thank you again for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lindsay Horvath, L.A. County Supervisor, representing the 3rd District from the Ventura County line to West Hollywood, City of San Fernando. She's the former mayor of West Hollywood.
Support for LAS comes from Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubrias, the Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin vote. Tickets at theatricum.com. Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Mix Mix, the Filipino Adventures of a German Jewish Boy by Boney B. Alvarez. Inspired by true events from the life of Ralph Price, after escaping Nazi Germany, a newfound tropical refuge in the Philippines is upended when Japan invades the islands. On stage through June 16th. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
It was a spirited morning before the U.S. Supreme Court in D.C. On one side, whiskey maker Jack Daniels. And on the other side, the maker of a squeaking dog toy that parodies the Jack Daniels bottle and label. The question for the justices, whether the maker of the parody toy infringed on Jack Daniels' trademarks. The company that makes that parody toy is based in Arizona. It's called VIP Products. The toy is called the Bad Spaniels toy, and it's part of a series of parodies of different products from which they make pet toys. Now, the original Jack Daniels bottle, in case you don't drink that brand of Tennessee whiskey, says Old Number 7 brand Tennessee Sour Mash Whiskey. On the parody dog toy squishy bottle, it says the Old Number 2 on your Tennessee carpet. So Jack Daniels, which is based in Lynchburg, doesn't find this particularly funny. So before the high court this morning, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson pressed the attorney for the dog toy company, VIP Products, on whether the speech printed on the dog toy would infringe upon trademark rights by making a reasonable consumer think that Jack Daniels had made it.
If you put it on a shelf, right, then you're not using it in commerce. You're not shopping it around and potentially confusing people into thinking that Jack Daniels is selling this. That's the whole heartland of the trademark.
I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about my hypothetical. If VIP Products sold that toy, not as a toy to be used with a dog, but as soft sculpture for people to buy and put on their shelf to get a good laugh at the joke, which at least some people get. In fact, that would take away its supposed utilitarian value, but it would keep its expressive value because what people laugh at is not the fact that it's a dog toy, it's the speech on it.
That's the attorney for VIP Products, which made the parody dog toy, Bennett Cooper. In her rebuttal, the legal counsel for Jack Daniels, Lisa Blatt, argued the justices weren't looking at the issue from all sides.
All trademarks are expressive. They have speech rights, and every time you infringe them, it's going to implicate speech by definition. And What the other side, and I don't hear you guys talking about, is the half of speech that no one likes, the pornography and the poison. And it is hard for me to see how you can say that the trademark owner doesn't have an interest in something that approaches compelled speech if their mark has been using in porn films and porn toys and sex toys, and people are profiting off of that.
I'm not sure about calling the justices you guys, but interesting comments from the attorney. With us, Harvard Law professor Rebecca Tushnet joining us, specializes in copyright, trademark, and false advertising law. Professor, thank you for being with us. You filed a brief in support of the toy-making company. How do you see this falling into what would be illegal use by the toy manufacturer?
So thank you for having me. And I encourage anybody who's interested to actually Google the images. And the one of the points of our brief was a test that says that Bad Spaniel's number two on your Tennessee carpet, that's a squeaky toy, that a test that would call that confusing with Jack Daniel's actual product is a dumb test. And so the test that we have, where we're looking for things like, you know, counterfeit batteries, or even frankly counterfeit bottles of Jack Daniels, the test that we use for figuring out whether that's confusing just doesn't make any sense applied to parody products. And free speech principles really back that up. So if you, for example, make fun of me, I generally don't have any remedy. Even if I think that's so unfair, I really don't want to be talked about that way. We don't say you have a property interest in not being made fun of. And Jack Daniels is basically saying, because we have a trademark, we should be treated better than somebody who doesn't have a trademark and being able to stop people making fun of us.
We're talking with Harvard Law professor Rebecca Tushnet, also with us from George Mason University School of Law, Adam Mossoff. He specializes in property, patent, trade secrets, and trademark law. And he similarly filed a brief, but on behalf of Jack Daniels in this case before the High Court. Professor Mossoff, share with us why you think that what VIP did with this dog toy infringed on Jack Daniels' rights.
Well, thank you as well for inviting me on your show today. And I think the important point to remember is that trademark law secures the valuable goodwill, is the term in the law, that is the valuable reputational effects that are created by commercial enterprises like Jack Daniels, but also Apple Computer and Disney and many other companies that expend incredible amounts of money, time, effort over many, many years. Jack Daniels is 150 years old, to create a valuable brand association, a reputation that is associated with their product and their service, and that is what facilitates their ability to continue to sell their wares to consumers and for consumers to find their wares in the marketplace. Trademark law has long secured this goodwill, as lawyers call it, to commercial enterprises, and that's all that Jack Daniels is doing in this instance, is establishing that there is, in fact, substantial consumer confusion. It submitted a survey that showed that it was almost one-third consumer confusion as to whether this toy was associated with or authorized by Jack Daniels, and that is more than enough than you need typically for a finding of trademark infringement. I mean, this is not a case of a comedian making fun of Jack Daniels or someone writing a book that poking fun at Jack Daniels. Jack Daniels wouldn't sue in those cases, and they haven't sued. What they have sued is someone who is making a product, a commercial product, and is selling it in a way that makes it clearly associated with Jack Daniels' famous marks, the shape of its bottle, the design of its label. It's not just a few words. It's the entire package of the of the dog toy, as Professor Tushnet says. I do recommend people Google it, because you will get a sense of how close it does resemble Jack Daniels' trademarks.
And Professor Tushnet, how would this be protected, given the fact that what makes it funny in a fun toy is that it plays on that characteristic shape and the language on the Jack Daniels bottle. So for someone who, say, is a fan of Jack Daniels, this is an extension of that in the purchase of the play toy with the pet. And so how does that not, in essence, leverage the value that Jack Daniels has, as opposed to something that's strictly parody, which is clearly protected?
Well, first of all, I want to make clear that Jack Daniels is arguing that nothing is protected, right? That's their argument, that if people believe, if less than one in three people believe that Jack Daniels' permission is required to make fun of it, then you can't make fun of it. At least if you are making anything that you sell in the market. And that includes movies and that includes books. And people with Jack Daniels theories have sued movies. They've sued books. They've sued video games. So this is actually a very broad claim. And I would just say, when you look at those two things, it is not a Jack Daniels bottle. It is clearly a play on the Jack Daniels bottle. And the problem with saying people are confused about that is that actually lots of people just don't think about this question. And so when you ask them, like, do you need Jack Daniels' permission to make fun of it? They sort of say, oh, well, I guess I've heard of trademarks. And so probably. So we're asking people questions that they're not equipped to answer. And we're asking people questions that don't matter to them. This is not like a counterfeit bottle of Jack Daniels, which everyone agrees, it matters to people that they're getting actual Jack Daniels. People don't care whether Jack Daniels gave its permission for this joke. We should not actually be using the law to suppress commentary just because Jack Daniels is rich and powerful, which is what Adam's plea here amounts to.
Is this really commentary, though, as opposed to making a product that's a fun product because of the association with the real thing?
So I want to actually contest that those matter, right? So think about, a column in the newspaper where somebody makes fun of the latest, social trend or what Elon Musk has done, right? Of course, they're focusing on Elon Musk because Elon Musk is much in the news. They're getting your attention because you're interested in Elon Musk, but that's still talking and commenting about. It's speech about Elon Musk. It is not saying, I am Elon Musk, impersonation. Again, everybody agrees impersonation is not great, but we should actually be free to take even, really expensive and powerful people and brands. We should be able to take them less seriously than they take themselves.
All right. We're talking with Harvard Law Professor Rebecca Tushnet. She filed a brief in support of the dog toy manufacturer VIP, which made this squishy dog toy in the shape of the Jack Daniels bottle with satirical comments that riff off of the actual writing on the bottle of Jack Daniels. Also with us, George Mason, Professor of Law, Adam Mossoff. Professor Mossoff, your response to Professor Tushnet.
Thank you. So I do want to clarify one point. Professor Tushnet said that they are arguing that, that no one should get this speech protection, and that's actually not the case. What they're arguing is the current test that is used, called the Rogers test, is incorrect and invalid because it doesn't account for the valuable goodwill that commercial enterprises create, and which the law has long secured going back to the 19th century in commercial enterprises and creating valuable marks, just like Apple does with its Apple, and Disney does with Mickey Mouse, and so on. And so what they were saying is that concerns about real parity are accounted for in the actual test because you won't get confusion by okay. consumers. You won't have same marketing and similar channels of commerce and things of that sort. And at the end real concern here. Yes, sorry.
No, that's right. We're just about out of time. Just real quick finish, please.
Oh, yeah. So the end of the day, real concern here is that you of course, you have very strong marks, very strong reputations, and those are the ones that are going to be parodied by other commercial enterprises. They're going to use this parity exception, which is so broad and overexpansive, as embraced by the Ninth Circuit and as argued for by Professor Tushnet, such that there would be zero protection, actually, at the end of the day, real protection for the valuable brands that have been created around the world.
I want to thank you. That's Adam Mossoff, George Mason University Professor of Law, Rebecca Tushnet, Professor of Law at Harvard University. Listening to Oye Mi Canto, a reggaeton single by Nori, released in 2004. It was a song you'd be apt to hear among the party crew scene of the 2000s. That's what we're going to talk about with a new podcast from LA Studios and from Vice. The podcast is Party Cruise, The Untold Story. It's hosted by Janice Yamoka. And let's listen to this from episode 2 of the podcast. It reminisces about the party crew days, these party crews in different Latino neighborhoods of Los Angeles back in the aughts. And here Janice reminisces about the days with one of her best friends from high school.
Would you remember your nickname?
I think it was like, what was it?
Was it Miss Caramel?
If you were in a party crew, chances are you had a nickname like Miss Caramel, Giggles, or Flaca. Sammy pulled out an old picture of us that she had on her phone and zoomed in into a big laminated card she was holding that was clipped on a lanyard that she was wearing around her neck. It was a badge, like a name badge, and it had her nickname on it. I remember making that badge on Photoshop, which I downloaded off LimeWire.
I have, oh yeah, it is Caramel Diva.
Oh, Caramel Diva?
Let's yeah, see. A little bit.
Oh my
yeah,
God.
Caramel Diva.
My nickname was Mocha, just a short version of my last name, Yamoka. I guess you can say I was the mocha to her caramel.
We're talking about the Party Cruise, The Untold Story from LA Studios and Vice. Joining us, reporter and senior producer at Vice and host of Party Cruise, The Untold Story, Janice Yamoka. Janice, thanks so much for talking with us about this 8-part series. And fill us in a little bit more about where these parties would be held in Latino neighborhoods of L.A. Were these largely house parties or in industrial spaces?
Hey, Larry. Thanks for having me. Yeah, so these parties, you know, were thrown in, you know, I'd like to say like someone's grandma's backyard. You know, sometimes I think the promoters would pay families like $150, $200 just to give them some cash so they could use their backyard, and they would clean up, you know, before, after the party was done. So then no one else would be in charge of the cleanup, but also like warehouses. Yeah. I think I remember pretty clearly it was kind of wherever we could find a free big space to throw a party.
And for the young people that would go to these, what was the age range and the type of music they'd hear played?
Yeah. So I would say, you know, as young as 13, 14. And, you know, I remember it mainly being a high school thing because people couldn't get into clubs, right? Even like the underage clubs were about 16 and up. And we couldn't even get into those. So I would say like 14, 15, 16, but there was, you know, 17, 18, 19. I think it also like ranges from there, but I would say the youngest from like 14 and older, maybe like on the older side of teenage year, so 19.
And
the music.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No,
oh, yeah. Yeah, the music. Yeah, just like you played in the intro. Oye mi canto, you know, reggaeton, there was hip hop. And it was, yeah, it was just a lot of dance music, you know, like dance where you're just like shaking and you're grinding. And it was just a lot of, you know, a lot of fun dancing. But yeah, I'm thinking like Ying Yang Twins and like Too Short. Daddy Yankee, Diego Calderon. That's the kind of music that we were hearing.
We're talking about a major part of Los Angeles culture from the 90s and from the aughts. Party Cruise, The Untold Story, a new 8-part podcast series, which was produced by LAS Studios and Vice, collaborating with iHeart's My Cultura podcast network to release this podcast, available wherever you get your audio. We're talking with the host of it. She's also reporter and senior producer at Vice, Janice Yamoka. Janice, you know, this is pre-social media. Was this largely from flyers that were posted in neighborhoods to invite people, or were the crews so recognized that just word of mouth was enough to get people to come?
Yeah, so I would say the 2000s, you know, the early 2000s was just at the beginning of social media, right? Like MySpace started in, I want to say, 2003, around there, you know, Techno for Us, which is an episode actually in our series that focuses on social media site that predates MySpace by a few months. But, you know, that was what party crew members were using. As far as the flyers, you know, originally they were printed, just like many generations before, printed flyers. Ours were like glossy and colorful, like a ton of color, because all the logos, all the party crews had logos and they were all colorful. And the flyers were very colorful too, but it wasn't posted. So it was like passed around, right? Promoters, other teens would kind of just like have a role as a promoter, and they would pass out flyers at school. They would pass out flyers at the mall, in the parking lots. They would slip it underneath the windshield wipers, just anywhere where they could get the word out. But then it kind of migrated to posting it on social media. So MySpace and Techno for Us did become a place where people posted flyers. And that's a place like kind of how they got the word out.
One of the things you focus on is the unsolved death of Emery Munoz, who was murdered in 2006. Her body was found at an industrial site where apparently there had been a party that had been held. And why the focus on her death? What is the, how is that an important piece of this story?
Yeah. So, you know, I think for me, just looking back at the past kind of brought a lot of, you know, pain and just like sad memories, and along with, you know, the good ones, I just didn't know how to grapple with it, you know, as an adult. And it was just a few years ago when I was doing some research on, you know, my era of party crews, the 2000s. And I was like kind of just looking for anything on the internet that proved our existence, because it isn't that well documented, the 2000s. But I did find a lot of news articles about Emery, and they were always just like, Emery was at a party. Emery was connected to the scene. Emery, it just was so focused on it. And I think for me, I saw like Emery as like she could have been my friend. She's like, I related to her in a lot of ways. And I think learning about her death and how much she was connected to that scene made me think, like, you know, if it were me, would I be talked about this way? And I think for me, I kind of made it somewhat of a mission to tell her story in a different way, right? Present her as a teen, present her as a girl with, like, you know, dreams and hopes and loves and all these things that a teen has. And also just really talk about that scene, because it was talked about so negatively that I wanted to kind of just share it from a different perspective. And I think that's really how Emery's case, you know, it's a huge important part of this story, because it actually allowed me to go back and kind of explore this time in my life again.
Well, and obviously Latinos all around Southern California dance, they go to parties, they listen to a wide range of music. Why did the party crew era come to a close?
You know, I have been doing like informal research. I've just been asking people that, you know, I've interviewed, asking them if they've heard of any party crews past 2010. I haven't been able to find anyone that says yes. Everyone's the kind of like the last years they've heard of it was 2008, 2009. You know, if there was past 2010, I haven't been able to find it. But, you know, I can imagine that the internet might have a huge thing like to do with it, because the internet's now a place where you can gather, right? It's digital, but party crews did serve that purpose. It was like a community. It was digital. I know digital can't replace in person, but I think maybe people just started relying more on digital communities as opposed to in-person communities. That's the only thing I can really think of that might have, you know, played a part in that.
Janice, thank you so much for talking with us about Party Crews, The Untold Story. 8 episode plus 2 bonus episodes of the podcast are available now wherever you get your podcasts, as we listen to Jay Kwan's 2004 recording Tipsy, which is illustrative of what party crews were like. This new podcast, by the way, made in cooperation between LA Studios and Vice, with iHeart's My Cultura podcast network. Thank you so much. Janice Yamoka is a reporter and senior producer at Vice.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism.
one lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.